KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Journalist Maureen Ryan has been exposing wrongdoing in entertainment for years, but it took a text rant to a friend to make her think that maybe she should write a book.
The factory that is designed to produce damaging workplaces actually has produced plenty of damaging workplaces. So some of it's like, oh no, it's not actually that new because we've seen this keep happening. But I wanted to dig deeper into why it keeps happening.
In Burn It Down, Power, Complicity, and A Call for Change in Hollywood, Ryan talks about her blistering takes on what went on behind the scenes at SNL and on the ABC series Lost. She also discusses the legal challenges of exposing powerful figures in entertainment, something I know a little bit about, and calls for measures she believes are needed to promote a healthy work environment for creatives. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy and banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So let's talk about the news. Let's see who has had a bad week. David Zaslav again.
Oh, he's the winner. It's getting out of control. He's the winner every week.
He's had a lot of scoring on that department lately. So he has talked about his great love for Turner Classic Movies. He has it on in his office. It's his favorite thing. And as has already been reported, you know, there was an outcry because the top leadership left on June 20th because they had been through a number of cuts, as we are now reporting in The Hollywood Reporter, including most recently this two-third cut in their salary budget. And the top leaders said, you know what, the only way we could get anywhere near that is just by doing in our own jobs. And they took a combination of buyouts and layoffs. And as we have already known, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, Paul Thomas Anderson, and many others in this business love this TCM service and were already complaining about the way it was being treated under AT&T. Things were much worse once David Zaslav, the man who loves it so much, took over. And instantaneously, the reaction when these people left was, what are you doing to TCM? And these are people that David Zaslav truly admires, truly wants these people to respect and admire him. And it was very clear that he had just stepped on a landmine about which he had been warned.
Yeah, and this is not the first time this has happened. It's like deja vu all over again. Since Zaslav took over Warner Discovery, I mean, we saw it with CNN. He professes this great love for the news business, and it's the crown jewel of news. Then he gets in the job, he scraps CNN Plus, and he starts firing people, and he puts a guy in the job that didn't have the credentials, it turned out, to run the network, and Chris Licht. It happened at HBO, where it's the crown jewel. It's all this, and then all of a sudden, shows start disappearing, and people start getting fired. He did it with Warner Brothers, where he, you know, this is the 100-year-old studio, and I get to sit at Jack Warner's desk. How lucky am I? And then all of a sudden, he's letting people off, and he's scrapping the Batgirl movie. This is a guy who is torn between two different mandates. He has this inner mandate to be loved and to be respected amongst the creative community, and this amazing job that he was given, a career cable TV guy running one of the great studios. And then he's got this other mandate where he essentially works for his creditors because the debt load on Warner Discovery is so great, and he's got to relentlessly cut costs in order to make this entire transaction work. And we see it come up over and over again, this push-pull.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about this, you know, if you are going to take a company where everything is going to be a big deal, and if you want to be somewhat fair to Zaslav, he was put into this thing with all the debt, and CNN is CNN, HBO is HBO, TCM is TCM. So everything you touch when you're trying to find the savings leads to all this blowback.
Zaslav was doing this for years with unscripted producers, where he would come in and he would put a henchman in charge and they would just cut, cut, cut and say, if you don't like it, then we're not going to deal with you anymore. We'll replace you on the shows. And nobody cared because these were reality shows and home improvement shows where they didn't get the kind of publicity that these other assets do. He was completely taken aback by how big a deal the Batgirl thing became. Because they said, you know what, it makes sense. We'll get a tax write-off. We'll scrap the movie. It's not good anyways. But this is a DC property. This is something that gets headlines all over the world. And it became a huge fiasco. And it happens over and over again with these assets.
Yeah, it's a tough row to hoe, but he also doesn't have this touch. And he was warned by Brian Lord at CAA. He was told, you are going to get blowback and it's not going to be fun. So what happens? They do it anyway.
They do it anyway, and then they're forced to scramble. And now, like in a lot of these other situations, they have this band-aid they've put on where now oversight over the creative at the network is going to be handled by Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi at Warner Brothers. And they brought back an executive who had said he was going to leave. And they've got these three name brand filmmakers who say they're going to curate the content on TCM. We'll see what that actually means. I envision an email they get once a month where the list is there and they say, okay, thumbs up, looks great. Maybe Eric Casablanca once or twice more. We'll see what they actually end up doing. But this is a PR fix for a more fundamental financial problem.
Well, I think they're going to read the room and not cut the budget and restore some of the cuts. That's what we're told.
Oh, are they? I have not read that they're going to restore the budgets for TCM.
That is, in fact, what I am being told by my sources, yes. And I'm also told that these filmmakers truly are going to be involved. And I heard that Paul Thomas Anderson already somehow had a role in getting Greta Gerwig to come and talk about Barbie, because Zaslav wanted more celebrities and, you know, big names on the thing. So
that's a good idea. I mean, they should be leveraging the community to get bigger names on TCM. If these creatives love the network so much, they should show it by putting themselves on there.
Let me turn to another subject, Netflix. You know, Netflix has been talking about how well prepared they are for the strike. And part of the reason is they're getting a lot of stuff out of South Korea, which is blossoming and burgeoning in film and TV. The LA Times has this story about how Squid Game, which was a huge hit at a time when Netflix really needed one, it added $900 million, they say, to the value of the company. How the creator is not getting any kind of residuals. I mean, this comes at a time, you know, when the writers are out and it's very tense with SAG-AFTRA, and they are talking about how Netflix hires these production companies and says to the LA Times, you know, it's not us, it's these other companies that are making the shows for us, which is okay. But the conditions in the film and TV industry in South Korea are absolutely shocking. Some crews are paid a day rate, but the day is defined as an unbroken filming that can go on for more than 24 hours. They are just exploited. This is like a scandalously, honestly. And I think this information, you know, coming in the middle of the writer's strike, it just is going to energize. I mean, I'm seeing it on my Twitter feed, and Twitter's not the real world. We know that because a lot of people said they weren't going to vote for the DGA deal, and then it was approved overwhelmingly. But I'm just saying that it's a bad look. I mean, Korea needs to take care of Korea, but, you know, if Netflix wants to be bragging on its content from there, I'm not sure you can just say, it's not us, we're just the beneficiaries.
Yeah, it's definitely a bad look. And the co-CEO, Ted Sarandos, all over his Instagram, he was in Asia talking about how great it is to work with our Korean partners. And here we've got an expose saying that they're not being treated very well. And Netflix could fix this if they actually wanted to. That's the thing is, yes, these are outside companies that make shows for them. But you know what? Netflix is a big global player and they could step up. Question is, will they?
Exactly. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Hollywood is a town where dreams come true, but sometimes turn into nightmares. Maureen Ryan is a journalist who's reported on industry misconduct for years. She's written for The Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, Variety, and she's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Her book, Burn It Down, Power, Complicity, and a Call for Change in Hollywood, was released on June 6th and is a New York Times bestseller. I think this book came about because you texted a friend about a bad behavior in Hollywood.
Well, you know, I text angry things to friends a lot, or I rant about things a lot, as you know, because we've known each other for a while. There was a particularly ranty series of texts that I sent to one friend 2.5 years ago that I looked at it again and, you know, I was like, burn this whole industry to the ground. Maybe don't even start over again. You know, I was working on a series of stories about more misconduct and things that were covered up and the usual. And I looked at those texts and I actually saved screenshots of them because I was like, within the grain of this ranting, I think there's a book proposal. And part of the motivation to write a book was I've always wanted to be a published author because that sounds like a cool thing to be able to say. And we both know what it's like to ourselves or watch other people publish work that definitely causes change or causes something to shift in the industry or causes, you know, somebody to lose a job somewhere or whatever. I wanted to write a book that got into these issues more deeply and just kind of said, you know, I keep going back to this thing Orlando Jones said to me, you know, it almost feels like the system is set up for this outcome. And by that, he meant a bad outcome or a series of bad outcomes. I think that there's more truth to that than I would like to admit sometimes. But the factory that is designed to produce damaging workplaces actually has produced plenty of damaging workplaces. So some of it's like, oh, no, it's not actually that new because we've seen this keep happening. But I wanted to dig deeper into why it keeps happening.
Yeah, you actually mentioned it at the beginning that this is a culture that exists in other businesses. And I think you mentioned newsrooms.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh,
and it
yeah.
made me think of a job I had long ago with this really, really abusive boss. And it was like a cult, you know, in that newsroom.
Yeah.
I was not there for it. And I pushed back, like in a meeting with all of these people. I was still pretty new there. I didn't stay long. And afterwards, people were like, you can't say that to him. You can't talk to him that way. And these are people, I would like to just clarify, that would, to, I guess, let off steam, would sit around trying to devise ways, in not totally serious, just as a release, to set things up so that this guy would accidentally kill his cat when he opened his apartment door. So
there's a lot of love for that. Yeah, that guy. But I mean, that's the thing, you know. One thing I think about a lot is at one point, one publication, it might have been Vox, had a list of just men in the media and journalistic industries that had been revealed to be, you know, serial abusers or serial harassers or both. And I'm like, boy, that's, yeah, that tracks, you know, it's not a news flash, but it's interesting what you said about it, like being a cult, because I think that's such a misconception that people have about the industry that I think actually in part based on the response to my book, I'm getting more and more of the feeling that people understand this more clearly now. Hollywood is not like a sharing circle where everybody is kind and eats, you know, organic yogurt. Like, it's very hierarchical. Everyone's very obsessed with status, and do not get someone's title wrong in a story. Oh my gosh, that would be a disaster. I often think of it as a series of linked autocracies, you know, because very few people on a film set or at a studio or on a TV production, very few people, maybe one or two or three people, have real meaningful ongoing power, and everyone else has zero power. And I think it's hard for people in the world to wrap their heads around that because they think of it, oh, it's creative and people are just jumping in and suggesting ideas and doing what they feel, what moves them in the moment. And I'm like, ooh, it's not like that so much for most people. No.
No. Well, let me start with the introduction that your book had to the wider world, which was the Vanity Fair excerpt on Lost. And people were almost destroyed from reading that. Now,
ooh,
I will confess that maybe this, I lose points. I never watched Lost. I never got into Lost. So I didn't have the emotional connection. But I don't know if you heard it, but I heard these wails like, no, it can't be true.
Well, I did. Yeah, there was a lot. And what's interesting is I thought it would be a shoot the messenger situation. I was wondering about that because, you know, if you write about popular culture, at some point you're going to get in the crosshairs of some fandom or other or subsect of a fandom. And then
write about the DC universe and see what happens.
Yeah, don't. I prefer not to. Thank you. Exactly. So I thought that the wailing and gnashing of teeth would sort of also take the form of, you know, Mo Ryan is a bad journalist and she did a bad job and she is, for bad reasons, impugning this wonderful pillar of pop culture. What's really interesting to me, and the thing that it took me a while to realize, I don't think that this book would have been received the same way 6-7 years ago. I don't think the Lost information would have been received the same way 6 or 7 years ago. As hard as it is, I feel like a little bit like a doctor. And I think probably, I don't know if you've ever felt like this. I'm not someone walking up to you on the street with a pickaxe and like hitting you with it for no reason, just for fun. I don't do that. That's not fun. I don't like inflicting pain. I hope I'm more like the surgeon who's saying, well, we got to like do this operation and it's going to involve some pain and some physical therapy and a difficult recovery, but you will be much healthier in the long run. I think that that's what good journalists do, is illuminate something, not even just about that production, but about the mechanisms by which people are protected from the consequences of their actions. And so I'm just going to say it. You're a role model for me and you have been for a long time.
Oh,
so I'm always very, very careful to say, There has been rigorous and excellent reporting on the industry for as long as I've been consuming reporting about the industry. And, you know, I think you're one of the best at doing that. And so I've tried to follow in your footsteps and in the footsteps of other people I admire, and trying to use my perch to say the industry wants to have this magical thinking facility happening. And that's okay for the page or the soundstage or when the cameras are rolling or whatever the AI is doing now. But like when it's about the workplace, it's a workplace. And I think there's much more understanding on the part of the public now that it is a workplace.
So how did you choose where to focus? I mean, you have Lost, then you go after SNL, which is also beloved, and you describe a very toxic culture with, you know, the story of this underage young woman who is hanging around and being assaulted in front of people like big names, like the biggest names, and they're seeing this and not doing anything. And of course, Lorne Michaels, who likes to be situated as this sort of overseer of the thing, and you portray him as being responsible for all of this. And then you did Sleepy Hollow. I mean, what made you go to those particular projects?
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do was illuminate specific things. Lost was a show that got a lot of credit for having an inclusive cast. What was it really like to work there during this time when having one token person of color in the writer's room was the norm, one or two? What was that experience actually like for them? With Lost and Sleepy Hollow in particular, over the years, I had heard enough things, or I had experienced myself enough things that made me question what went on there. I just had a great deal of curiosity to find out more. With SNL, it was partly that this lawsuit was filed in 2021, and there was a flurry of coverage around it, but there have been...
Right, by the young woman and I mentioned
by,
just now.
And by the way, she did... That lawsuit has now been... The case is closed. And an interesting fact, Jane Doe never signed an NDA. So that's interesting. I wonder what will happen with that. She went up against this gigantic corporation and this very powerful set of people. And she told me before that case ended, I don't want to sign an NDA. And then, you know, later I found out that she didn't. So it was partly with SNL, I just felt like amongst critics and reporters of my generation, we don't really cover comedy in a systematic way that talks about how abusive paradigms are celebrated there. And SNL is part of that, frankly, I think. Part of it was like, what can I do in the time frame that I have? And what can I safely get through the legal review process? Because as you know, that can often take as long or longer than the actual fact gathering and writing and interviewing. You know, there's the research interviewing process, and then that overlaps some with the writing process, but then the legal vetting takes months. And for this book, the legal process was extreme. But yeah, people in the industry don't, especially when they've achieved a certain level of power and influence and access and all of those things, they are not used to this kind of pushback, especially where their image is concerned. That part of it is tough. If I had it to do all over again, would I have poked this many bears in this, you know, relatively compressed period of time? No, I would not. You know, it just was what it was. But when people feel seen, especially when they feel like they haven't had a voice or an ability to be seen because this industry can be so harsh and so vindictive, that is really interesting for me. And, you know, you can't meaningfully move forward unless there's an honest accounting of what occurred. And that's what I'm trying to get at with the book is, and I think a lot of other quality journalists like yourself, like, let's not go into the land of magical thinking. Let's talk about the reality of what these jobs are like and the reality that people are not trained properly or monitored properly. And so I did a big interview with Jeff Garlin. I couldn't figure out, and nobody at the studio would tell me in a direct way, what was going on with his employment status at the Goldbergs in the fall of 2021. And then after that interview came out, more of my inboxes filled up because people are really tired of having to stay silent about certain things, and they didn't feel like the full story was there, and they wanted to have their voices added to the mix. And I think...
Yes, he was very unrepentant in this interview you had with him about his behavior. He was like, it's a joke, and that's how I roll, and that, you
it's
know...
It's just funny. It's just funny behavior. And then some people were in my inboxes and saying, here's what he described as funny behavior, and it wasn't funny to me at all. And I just feel like the studios are constantly still on the back foot with this stuff and don't want to be proactive about it. And I'm just tired of that.
Coming up after the break, Maureen Ryan weighs in on Warner Brothers' support of Ezra Miller leading up to the release of The Flash. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. I'm speaking to my fellow journalist, Maureen Ryan, about her best-selling book, Burn It Down. I want to touch on this Issa Rae quote that is in your book. She's talking about Ezra Miller, who obviously just had a problem with The Flash not opening anywhere near what Warners had hoped for. The quote is, "I'm going to be real. The stuff that's happening with Ezra Miller is to me a microcosm of Hollywood. There's this person who's a repeat offender, who's been behaving atrociously, and as opposed to shutting the production down, there's an effort to save the movie and them. That's a clear example of the lengths Hollywood will go to save itself and to protect offenders." That's certainly a forthright quote. Mm-hmm. I don't know, though, what is Warner supposed to do in that situation? I mean, they have this person in a big project, which they could dump, and if things had gone south, they claimed they would. But, you know, at a certain point, they managed to get Ezra out of the public eye. But that, you know, when you're putting that much money, by the way, I wrote a big piece about what happened on Justice League with Joss Whedon. And to me, that was more of the same, where they just kept going with this behavior, yeah. You know, because they were pregnant with this movie and they wanted to just get through.
Then just admit it, you know, just put out a press release saying, we care most about making money from this. And I mean, I can't have the Warner Brothers conversation without talking about Batgirl. You know, they shelved a movie in which, to my knowledge, people acted appropriately and professionally while within a creative environment. So I feel like, to me, that I will always pair The Flash with Batgirl. They shelved a really promising film that, I don't know, for me, maybe it was bad. I don't know. But, you know, a young woman of color was going to get this big opportunity, and they just dumped that. And to me, that's what makes The Flash situation that much more troubling. I do understand they are making these big investments of time and money and promotion and all of that. But what about the survivors of what Ezra Miller did? How do they feel about it? Where are they in this conversation? You know, if you were working on that set, did you feel safe? You know, did you feel like you had recourse if you felt unsafe for any reason? And that's why, you know, for the book, I talked to a rabbi. I talked to a criminal justice psychological expert. I talked to all these experts about, okay, we can't just say, oh, industry be better. How do we actually do that? You know, what disappointed me about the Louis C.K. situation is that he may still have it. I haven't looked, but he has his own site for dropping specials. He has his own distribution methods for, you know, distributing his own shows that he made kind of out of his own pocket. He has a mailing list and so forth. He had skills as a storyteller. Why not use all of that to essentially make amends and explore the topic of sexual violence and why so many men are raised in an arena and in a series of belief systems that makes them think, in some cases, that it's okay?
I had high hopes for him. I did.
But, I did too.
He did not fulfill my high hopes. Yeah, I was disappointed.
No, I mean, my lodestone there is, you know, Julia Wolof, who was a survivor of that situation, a promising comedian in her own right that wanted a career. And now she's said to Variety when Louis C.K. won a Grammy, nothing has changed and nothing matters. And I don't have a good rebuttal for that, because what we can talk about people doing is making amends and atoning either to the individuals harmed or to the communities harmed. And that's what's completely missing about The Flash. You know, yeah, what wow. did the studio do except close its eyes, pray for the best, and hope that it all went away?
Well, for what it's worth, it was reported that Ezra Miller did kind of apologize to them, the studio. Sorry, I screwed up. When
right.
you have this giant movie.
Yeah, I'm sorry that your millions might be, you know, set on fire. But like, you know, if you create harm in the world, how are you going to try to undo that harm?
Yes. Let me ask you one last thing. Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, the showrunners of Lost, had very different reactions to your questions. Carlton Cuse responded through a PR person with written answers, and basically some of it just denied, and I never would, that's outrageous. Damon just fell on the floor and said, I did it, I feel terrible, I hope that I'm not that person anymore, and I would rather have all my talent taken from me just to hear that I behaved sympathetically. And we both know Damon a little bit, you know, and spent time with talking to him. He's always perfectly charming and straight and not overly sensitive when you ask him questions. So what do you make of that, Damon Lindelof? Are you like, that's the answer? Or are you like, I would like to know if you're still at it in some way because I don't trust?
I think in general in the industry, I'm trying to have healthy skepticism, Kim. Sometimes I have cynical skepticism and that doesn't feel so good, but the industry kind of put that level of pessimism in me on some days. I think that in general, we need to stop building up people. And I did it. I did it too. I built up people and put them on pedestals, and I just don't want to do that anymore. I mean, the thing is, they both said in various permutations of the following statement, I don't recall those. You know, I read them each a litany or showed them in Cuse's case documents, like, here's a list of things that were said in this workplace. They both said that they did not recall those statements being made.
Just to be clear, these are very racist or inappropriate comments that you cringe when you read them. Yeah.
So there is that commonality. And, you know, if I'm honest with you, that's something I'm sure you've gotten that too with stories. Many times I've worked on stories and the response that I get is like, I have no memory of that, or I didn't know that that was happening. And my generalized response, even beyond Lost, is if you didn't know that this was happening or didn't notice that this was happening repeatedly according to our sources and you didn't clock it at all, that's also a problem within the workplace, you know? There was a differing response, but I do think, I'll just speak for myself, it's very easy to become enthusiastic about a project and then transfer that enthusiasm uncritically to the people who made it. And I think I've done that a lot, and I understand why I do it. I think I do it from a good place. I think a lot of fans do it too. But I think at this point now, I have, as I say, we can love the property, the film or the TV show. If you go back and watch Lost, I'm not going to ding you. If it meant something to you, I'm not going to be mad at you. It still remains a landmark series in the history of American television. Like, you can't argue with that. You know, it just is. But I think for me, the valuable thing to do is to take a look at how we all fed these systems of, oh, the genius auteur, and that fed into the genius auteur who could do no wrong, which then fed into this idea of, well, creativity has to encompass some toxicity or abuse or biases of various kinds. And I no longer think that. I think that if there's a set with 400 people on it, or there's an office building on the Warner Brothers lot or any other lot with 2,000 people in it, all of those people are human beings. All of those people deserve to have their basic humanity respected, and they all deserve decent treatment. And for far too long, the industry has tried to skate by in a manner that doesn't routinely do that. And I'm not going to stop shouting about it until that's much more the norm, which means I might be shouting for another, I don't know, 200 years, something like that.
If you manage to do that, let me know how. Maureen Ryan is a writer and contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Her book, Burn It Down, is now available everywhere. Thank you so much, Maureen.
Thank you so much, Kim.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from John Meek, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.